Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Kay Potok, together with my co-host, Jim Werbel. Hello, Jim, and hello to you, the listener.
Good morning, Kay, and good morning, everyone. A couple of weeks ago on this show, we had a segment on various addictions and their treatment. Addiction is an important topic as it influences so many people directly and indirectly. To show the breadth of addictions, here's a brief quotation from someone we're calling Al.
People can be addicted to many different things, and in general, the problem deep down is probably the same problem, that there's some hole in your life or something in your life that you don't like that you would like to have changed or that you want different than what it is in reality. And when you have an addictive personality, that addiction can be almost anything. It could be sex, it could be drugs, it could be alcohol, it could be shopping, it could be eating, it could be gambling. People have lots of different ways to try and overcome that feeling.
As Al said in that recording, people can be addicted to many different things. And today we're going to start with an addiction that's not often talked about, sex addiction. Our first interview today is with the woman we're calling Jane Doe, who was married for more than 20 years to someone with a sex addiction, and who finally, at the end of that time, realized the true explanation for the puzzling things that had been going on in her marriage. Jane Doe wanted to give other people the chance to learn from her experience, so she came to our studios to tell her story, which we'll share with you today. To follow up with this difficult topic, we also have an interview with Michelle De La Riva of Community and Family Resources, a therapist who specializes in treating all kinds of addictions. And today, Michelle focuses on the topic of sex addictions.
Then, in the second half of the show, we have an interview with two people we're calling Al and Frank, who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous and who have both been in recovery from alcoholism for many years. They talk about the consequences of their addictions and how their lives have changed since they joined a 12-step program.
But to start, before hearing the interview with Jane Doe, let's hear a brief comment about sex addiction from an expert's point of view. Here's a brief extract of what the therapist Michelle De La Riva had to say after listening to the interview with Jane Doe.
People do not want to come forward to say, yep, my problem is I have a sexual addiction. I sit and look at pornography for 5 hours a day. Because what do people say? They say, well, stop it. Addiction is out there. It's destigmatizing the issue that will help people come forward. The most common misconception is that sexual addiction is all about sex, just like eating disorders are all about food or gambling is about money. All three of those things are untrue. So people with addiction disorders are trying to escape the stress, the anxiety, the depression. Most addictions really have to start with reducing stress and anxiety, depression. People certainly do struggle from this compulsive behavior. It is real. It does happen. There are signs to look for, and it is treatable.
And now let's hear the interview with Jane Doe. At her request, her voice has been very much disguised in this recording. It doesn't sound a bit like her real voice. Now we have in the studio, I'll say Jane Doe, who very courageously is going to tell us about her personal experience with this difficult topic. Welcome, Jane. I'll call you Jane.
Oh, thank you, Kay.
Why don't you tell us, first of all, why you thought it was so important to talk on the radio about this?
My experience has been so terrible that I would never wish this on anyone. I hope I don't have any enemies, but I would not wish it on my worst enemy if I had any. I really believe that most people don't want to believe this exists. Some people don't know it exists, and even if they do, they don't want to talk about it and they don't want to believe it. But it's absolutely true. There are sex addicts, and there are people right here in Ames, Iowa, and around this area. In fact, there are many of them. And this is something that you know, someone who's dating, someone who's about to get married, you know, if you have any doubts, you should really talk to your partner and see if you can get any concrete answers. My ex-husband would not give me any answers about anything. And don't doubt yourself. If you think something's wrong, there's probably something wrong, and it's probably something you need to look into to assure yourself that this isn't going to be a problem.
So you should trust your intuitions.
Yes, you should. And that's one problem. I have doubted myself so often over the past 20-plus years.
And which is the length of time you were married.
Right.
So this is, it's like forewarned is forearmed. You want to warn people what to look out for. Why don't you give us some of the things that people should look out for? You could just talk from your own experience.
Well, for instance, when I was dating my ex-husband, I went to his house after work one night, and there were some, well, actually there was one publication on that particular night laying on his kitchen counter, and it was one of the types of catalogs that these companies put out and that advertised women from foreign countries, and the company's specialty is setting up meetings between these women who are looking for American husbands and Americans. I asked him why he had a publication like that, and he said, well, someone must have found out he was single and signed him up for it.
So this was something he was receiving in the mail regularly?
I believe so. And then another time, there was a publication on his kitchen counter that was for a swingers organization. Mm-hmm. And I asked him why he was receiving something like that, which was quite a bit more shocking even than the magazine that I'd seen before, the
catalog.
But at least that was allegedly about getting married, not about, you know, playing the field or whatever.
Yes, but the swingers publication, right. I should have seen a red light or something then. I should have really looked into that a little deeper. When I did question him about it, he said, well, I guess once you get on one list, you get on all of them, which is
actually... Which sounds sort of plausible.
Well, at the time it did. Now it was...
Another red light.
Another red light, yes. A warning sign, I guess you would say. These things, you don't want to appear to be, you know, insecure or jealous. And so I guess maybe things that you should question, you don't question. I think that was the case with me. Women especially are always told not to be insecure, not to act jealous or insecure or, you know, untrusting because it's unattractive. But if this is something that could save you from, you know, 20 years of marriage to a sex addict, you know, it's probably worth looking into. I will never doubt myself again after this.
What about that kind of thing, yeah?
About that kind of thing, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then after you were married, there were lots of things that were very strange going on.
Yes, there were. For instance, sometimes I would wake up in the middle of the night and my ex-husband, would not be there. I can see the look on your face.
Yeah, well, that's something you hadn't mentioned before. That was a surprise to me.
Yes. Sometimes I would wake up and he wouldn't be there. You know, I'm not the kind of person that likes to get up once I'm in bed.
Of course not.
But sometimes I couldn't get back to sleep, and he wouldn't come back to bed for quite a long time. His excuse was always that he couldn't sleep, so he went downstairs to work on his computer until he got drowsy. Well, I think what he was doing was either looking at pornography, or even in some instances, I think maybe he was calling people to come to the house. One night I woke up in the middle of the night and I heard voices downstairs, but I didn't want to believe that this was happening. I, you know, just put it out of my mind.
When you first said he wasn't there, I thought you meant he'd left the house.
Well, in some cases he may have. I don't know. As I was saying, I woke up and I heard voices, and I could hear at least two voices.
Wasn't a phone?
No, it wasn't. Not, and I don't think at that time we had a speakerphone. But if we did, the speakerphone was on. Yes, I heard these voices, and I didn't want to believe this was happening. So I kind of put it out of my mind and tried to go back to sleep. Then the next morning, I asked my ex-husband, who was at our house the night before? And he said, oh, the speaker on the computer must have been on. But I really do believe, especially now, that there was someone in our house.
Did you? You didn't think of just putting on a robe and walk? I think that's what I'd have done, just walked down there and gone in to see what was going on.
Well, it was kind of frightening to think that someone was in my house and not know who it was. But I kept thinking about all the money and all the time and all the effort I'd put into the wedding, the honeymoon. We went on a cruise for our honeymoon. You know, we bought a house together.
So you were like protecting your emotional and financial investments here.
Right. Yeah. I just didn't want to believe that I was going to have to give up everything that I had invested.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you do invest a lot. I mean, emotionally, when you marry someone, you want to protect your.
Right. And I just bought all new furniture for the house. And, you know, it was just too much. It was just overwhelming to even think that somebody, and it was a female voice. One of the voices was a female voice. To think that someone could be in my house, could be invading my home. Now, if something like that happened, I think I would call the police. I really do.
Right.
Yeah, because it could be burglars.
It could be.
Oh, yeah.
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 And there are just so many possibilities.
And then you mentioned if you were in a store or a restaurant, he'd disappear for sometimes an hour at a time, you mentioned.
Yes, a couple of times when we were in bigger cities, we both went to the restrooms, and I came out, and he was not out yet and didn't reappear for about an hour's time. And then about 3 years before we split up, we were in a department store and he wandered off. And I could not find him for about an hour, maybe a little more. That time, he didn't even pretend that he'd gone to the restroom. He said that he'd been in the store all that time and I just couldn't find him.
Which you know wasn't true because you searched the whole store.
Well, yes. And besides, that's just rude to do to anyone.
Right. Yes. 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 Okay, and what was the final straw that broke the camel's back?
Well, actually, I had thought about divorcing about 3 years before the final straw. And at that time, I had a lot of other problems caused by family problems and pressures. And I put off getting the divorce. Well, what happened was that my ex-husband was arrested one evening for going to a prostitute. And this was part of a sting operation, and it ended up becoming very public. This was just, as you said, the last straw. All of my suspicions were confirmed. I then believed that everything I had feared was actually happening and had happened. And when I spoke to him and tried to get straight answers, I got no satisfaction. I got no apology. I went and bailed him out. I really didn't get a thank you for bailing him out or an apology until I mentioned that I hadn't gotten either. He had no remorse. He will not even admit he has a problem. And it was just hopeless. So I decided that the best thing to do was to part ways. And I found a lawyer and proceeded with a divorce.
Yes, and you also checked up. I mean, there's a horrible possibility of disease in this situation.
Right. After the arrest, I was in shock for about 3 days. And the third day, when I finally came to a little bit, I realized I needed to protect myself. So I made three appointments. I made an appointment at the clinic to be tested for STDs. I made an appointment with a counselor. And I made an appointment with a lawyer. And, you know, it was just a matter of time.
And fortunately, there were no children involved. Right?
No children, no. Yes. And both of my parents by that time were deceased, which I think was also
a blessing.
A blessing, yes, because they didn't have to know about this. It was just a terrible thing, especially when it ended up being on the news and in the newspaper. To this day, I don't know who knows and who doesn't. Some people saw it and didn't know what to say. and then later I might be talking with them, and it might come out that they knew all the time. Other people didn't see it at all, so I never know.
How long has it been since your divorce has been finalized?
My divorce was finalized last August.
So it's not been very long.
No, and I could not make my ex-husband leave the house. I told him I wanted him to leave, and he wouldn't. My lawyer advised me that because he owned half of the house, I could not make him leave until it was decided who was going to keep the house. And then the divorce had to be final before the other person would have to leave. I did decide to keep the house and buy out his half interest. In Iowa, the property is supposed to be split 50-50, the property that was acquired after the marriage. But the pressure and stress of having him in the house while we were going through the divorce proceedings was immense. It was very, very hard on me.
Did you ever wish you just left him sit in the jail for this? I don't know if he'd been out by then. That would have been a natural.
I think I was in shock. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of wish that I would have let him sit in jail. But all I could think of at the time was that he had to be at work the next morning. And what had happened was the night he was arrested, he did not come home, and it was getting to be very, very late. He had the type of job where he might have to work late on any given evening, but usually he would call me and let me know, usually before 6 o'clock, if he was going to be late, and he had not done that. So I did call his bosses, and so his bosses knew what happened, and I guess the idea was that I thought he had to be at work the next morning or he would be in a lot of trouble. And I guess I shouldn't have concerned myself with that, but I think I was in shock.
Sure. Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to say to people to end with?
Yes. Being married to a sex addict is like being abused. And I would not wish this on my worst enemy, as I've said before. I know that there are people who have old-fashioned, backward ideas, and they blame at least part of a sex addiction. They blame on the spouse. I know that there are women who are sex addicts, but from what I've read and what I've seen on the internet, they are few and far between. So mostly this is a woman's problem, although there are men who are also married to sex addicts. Do not think that it is your fault if you believe that you might be married to one, because it is not your fault. These people are very, very good at hiding what they are doing. And in most cases, they've had this problem a long time before they met you. And they have just become so used to hiding it that they're very good at hiding it from you. So do not blame yourself. Take care of yourself. And don't doubt yourself.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Kay Patuck, one of your hosts for today, together with my co-host, Jim Werbel. We've just been listening to an interview with someone we're calling Jane Doe, who was married to a sex addict for more than 20 years. That was obviously a horrible experience for her. We didn't play the complete interview because of time constraints, but I should say that in one part that I had to leave out, Jane did talk about the steps she's taken to help her own recovery from this trauma. She mentioned an online support group called Sisterhood of Support, and we'll put that up on our website. She also talked about her experience with two different face-to-face therapists. And in the next interview, we'll hear from another therapist who's an expert on different kinds of addiction, Michelle de la Riva of Community and Family Resources. Before we made this recorded interview, Michelle did listen to the complete interview with Jane Doe, and so she's able to give her expert perspective on this difficult situation. For an expert opinion on this difficult topic, I'm pleased to welcome Michelle de la Riva of Community and Family Resources, and she has kindly agreed to talk to us about this. and she has listened to a recording of what you might call a victim, someone who was married to a sex addict for many years and finally realized and admitted to herself what was going on. And Michelle has listened to that recording. And, well, why didn't you start off by saying what you thought of that experience that you've just heard about?
As far as the recording, what I really felt for the gal that was married to the person who had the addiction is that she really had a lot of self-doubt at the beginning, and she had many warning signs that perhaps her husband was engaging in activities that she would not have approved of. It sounds like she did try some interventions with him as well, and were unsuccessful. So I'm hoping that part of our conversation that we can really talk about what are some of the signs and symptoms and what can you do if you think that you might be married to someone who has an addiction.
Okay. Well, is sex addiction real? Because at one point, Jane Doe did say that a therapist doubted her when she was describing what was going on with her husband.
Sure. You've probably heard of sex addiction. You know, they mm-hmm. talk about it on television. It's on the internet. But you might be surprised to know that there's a debate about whether it is truly an addiction. And you'd even be more surprised to know that it's not even about sex. The most common misconception is that sexual addiction is all about sex, just like eating disorders are all about food or gambling is about money. All three of those things are untrue. Sex addicts are simply not people who crave lots of sex. Instead, they have underlying problems like stress, anxiety, or depression that drive their often risky sexual behavior. So those are the core issues that often therapists or counselors treat when somebody comes in with some sort of addiction, whether it be sexual addiction, gambling addiction, or addiction to drugs or alcohol. You won't see sex addiction in the upcoming edition of the DSM-5, which is used to diagnose mental disorders, but it does not mean that it's not an actual real problem that people face.
So the signs. Now, would these be signs? Well, I suppose it works both ways. For
Correct.
The person themselves to watch out for, but also someone married to.
Correct. What you'll find with the signs of addiction, and specifically for sexual addiction, is compulsive masturbation, impulsive, repetitive use of pornography. It could be the usual magazines, or it could be internet pornography, casual or anonymous sex. So she talked about that meeting someone.
Well, she wasn't clear what was going on.
She wasn't positive what was going on,
but
now she thinks that perhaps
right.
he was meeting someone in the restrooms or leaving restaurants and meeting up with someone. Involvement with strip clubs, adult bookstores, virtual sex sites, chat rooms, those types of things. Engaging in prostitution or sensual massage, so either hiring prostitutes, prostituting oneself would be a sign. Unprotected sex, seeking out sexual experiences without considering the possible consequences. So when you look at addiction, people often engage in risky behaviors without thinking about what possibly could happen next. And that's with all addictions. Sexual offenses typically is something to really look for. So maybe they're getting picked up for voyeurism, exhibitionism, those types of things. And then smartphones now. People certainly are spending more time, you know, sexting. You probably have seen that.
So I've seen that term, and apparently
yes.
it's a problem even with high school.
Absolutely.
Students.
But what you will find out with the addiction part, it is not about having fun or engaging in sexual behaviors, but it's more about the escape. So people with addiction disorders are trying to escape the stress, the anxiety, the depression.
Mm-hmm.
So just like alcohol numbs you for sexual addiction, the actual thinking about having sex, the planning for sexual activity, the going online, the chat rooms is more of the arousal than the actual sex act. So in the interview, Jane talked about that her husband would disappear in the middle of the night working on the computer.
Allegedly working on the computer.
He was on the computer.
Oh.
He could have certainly been on the computer. He could have been on chat rooms. He could have had he could be on all sorts of different things.
Okay.
He could have been looking at pornography. He could have been
trying
to find a prostitute. But spending the time thinking about the activity is a way to escape as well. So maybe he had a very high stress job. You know, I don't know anything about him, just the things that she talked about. But what we find is with people who have the sexual addictions is that they find relief in the fantasy. It gives them time away to think, you know, from thinking about what's going on in their life. You know, if you think about somebody at a casino sitting in front of the little slot machines,
right?
They don't look like they're having a fantastic time, unless they're on a commercial. They really are escaping
from
just life. You know, they probably did win something at one point. So even with sexual addicts, there was some relief in the sex act to begin with. But most people that are addicted to sex don't even find that much relief or excitement in the actual sexual act. And I think that's what's really hard for their spouse or the person they're in a relationship with to really understand. So Jane talks a little bit about how people are saying, if you were taking care of your man and their needs, this wouldn't happen, but that's not.
It's not true.
It's not true.
But that brings up another issue. Jane, when the sort of straw that broke the camel's back, she just basically divorced, you know?
Yeah.
Would it ever be a good idea to try to work through this with your partner? Of course, they've got to be willing to talk about it and admit they want help.
Right.
Which Jane's husband was not.
It's a very shameful situation. You know, for a person who finds themselves in the throes of sexual addiction, that is so shameful and embarrassing to say to someone, yeah, I'm not even sure why I'm doing this. I have no idea why I keep getting drawn up in the middle of the night to go look at porn to relieve my anxiety. How would one explain that to your spouse? So it's just like the alcoholic who has alcohol bottles hidden around the house, or the drugs hidden around the house, or gamblers. Gamblers disappear for days at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll say, oh, no, you know, they'll make up all sorts of excuses. So it's the same thing. I think most addictions really have to start with reducing stress and anxiety, depression. Doctors would likely be ones that would be more apt to see some of these signs even. Like I know at the local hospitals here and medical clinics, they've started to do depression screenings,
mm-hmm.
which is great. And they're asking a lot of questions about how people are doing. And hopefully some folks will start opening up even to physicians
uh-huh.
about depression. Because people don't come to treatment for this type of thing unless they get caught. Which is exactly what happened with Jane's spouse. He got arrested.
So as a general rule, people will not discuss this with their spouses before they're caught.
Probably not. Now,
yes.
Jane had some signs.
Yes.
Had she known that these were signs, then perhaps there had been more of an avenue to say, hey, let's sit down and talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
Most therapeutic interventions are going to focus on cognitive behavioral therapy,
mm-hmm.
where you really look at the triggers that are pushing a person towards the behavior and then really helping you to start thinking about that behavior differently and coming up with ways to modify the way you react to that trigger. Really, CBT skills are what we typically use.
CBT, cognitive behavior.
Cognitive behavioral therapy.
So the cognitive part means, I know what cognition, we know what cognition means, but it means thinking more about your own behavior.
Thinking about the triggers to the behavior.
Okay.
So cognitively teaching someone to really look at that cycle. What is it that you're thinking about that leads you to that behavior?
Okay. What exactly are you thinking?
Do you do?
Like when you reach for that cigarette or that drink
Correct.
Or that
Correct.
Pornographic magazine or what
Correct.
Exactly is going through your, or maybe how are you feeling in your muscles and where do you feel tension and that
Correct.
Kind of.
All of those types of things.
Right.
Getting people to really focus on their mind and body and then how they respond and what would be a better way to respond. It takes time. It is very effective. You know, and with this particular case, I can't really say, since I don't know her husband, what would have been effective for him. But knowing what are some of the signs, I'm hoping that
mm-hmm.
people will then be able to intervene to say, you know, I'm concerned about you. It'd be very difficult to say that. But there certainly are lots of support groups out there. There's lots of people who have addiction in their life. Most people, if you say, do you know anyone in your family that's ever had any sort of addiction? People say yes. Yes. Whether it be alcohol, drugs, sexual addictions. Nicotine addiction is out there. It's destigmatizing the issue that will help people come forward.
Right.
People
right.
do not want to come forward to say, yep, my problem is I have a sexual addiction. I shouldn't look at pornography for 5 hours a day. Because what do people say? They say, well, stop it. Right?
Snap out of it, yeah.
Right. Throw your computer out. Yeah. What's wrong with you?
Okay, so the first step has to be that the person wants to get out of this cycle. And
yes.
Then probably a good person to speak to would be their doctor about
Could
their
be. Anxiety. I mean, I think doctors are pretty non-threatening.
Right. And maybe get treatment for depression or whatever.
Yeah.
And then obviously some therapists know more about this area. They will
Correct.
Stick to sex addiction for the moment. Now, you specialize in addictions.
Correct.
But there's so many therapists out there, and there's art therapists, and there's all sorts mm-hmm. of therapists. And how do you know you're going to find a therapist that knows about this, believes in this? Because apparently at one point, Jane Doe had a therapist that really didn't believe her.
I think that's a tough question. I know in our particular agency at Community and Family Resources, because we have a combined team of substance abuse counselors and therapists, that this type of addiction we treat regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, we absolutely would not discount it.
No.
But I think it just depends on the therapist's experience. And it sounds like that she started with somebody who really did not have a good understanding of addiction. Or perhaps Jane left out some of the details.
Right.
I don't know. The story that she said about her husband disappearing, spending hours and hours on the computer, pornographic magazines and materials, all of those are signs that something mm-hmm. is amiss. Mm-hmm. She was right on target. It's just unfortunate
right.
that it took so long.
Right. So in terms of looking for a therapist, though, they can go to a place like Community and Family Resources, which specializes in addiction, or...
When you call to make an appointment, I would certainly, you know, typically... Most agents will ask, you know, what the presenting problem is, you know, like, what would you like to come in? And they try to match you with mm-hmm. a therapist that has experience. So that would be my advice, too, is that you ask, you know,
right.
is there anybody
okay.
in your agency that has experience? So that you make sure that you're getting the best advice possible.
Now, I noticed when you're listening to Jane Doe's recording and she was talking about the support groups and the different kinds of support
yeah.
groups, I noticed you nodding at certain points in that
Yes.
And
I thought it was fabulous. There are support groups not only for the addict, but for the person who's in the relationship with the addict. Support groups are very powerful because it's full of people who have been through the same thing. So Jane really was describing how she was talking about what her particular relationship looked like, and somebody else was saying, yes, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there too. I think that really sounds like it helped her to forgive herself for not picking up on the signs.
Right.
I think sometimes people are labeled as being codependent. You know,
they don't
so it's,
seem to use that term. Thank goodness.
Which is good. Because when you're living with somebody who is actively addicted, just like living with any other person, if your spouse normally gets up at 7 o'clock, goes, eats oatmeal, you know, it's normal. So you'd notice if he decided to have Cheerios. But if normally, you know, and you might comment on it, but, you know, same with somebody that lives with an addict. The addict does what they do on a regular basis and you get used to it. And they seem normal until there really is a problem. When the addiction starts spiraling, those are the things that she was noticing. At first, she saw a few of the things like the magazines. He probably had magazines hidden all over the house. Or... He was getting up in the middle of the night looking at the pornography and then denying.
The fact that when they were dating, he had that out on the counter. I mean,
yeah,
that's...
Yeah. And it's unfortunate, you know, that she was in this relationship for so long without knowing, because had there been intervention earlier, it could have changed the whole scenario. If you think 20 years ago, I mean, how many people would come forward? Even now, people do not come forward to say, yes, my spouse has some sort of addiction. Certainly not sexual addiction.
No, that does seem very, very embarrassing.
Very embarrassing, because people blame the spouse, even if they don't say
it. Well, even if they don't, people just don't talk about these things.
Right. Jane experienced this and how this affected her life in a very real way. She loved him. I think that it sounds like she did try to do some intervening, but she wasn't really certain as to what is the problem.
Right.
And it wasn't until towards the end of the marriage when it became more evident. And at that point, there's also a struggle. You know, people value marriage. They value their relationships. There's a lot of things that go into your marriage. So you think, like, I'm going to hang in there. and hope that things change. Mm-hmm. They'd both gone to counseling. So that says that she absolutely tried to intervene. He perhaps was not ready, or maybe the counselor wasn't a good fit for him. It's hard to know. Or maybe he was starting to make progress but relapsed, and that's what, you know, got him arrested.
Okay.
It's hard to know since we didn't get to speak to him.
Now, for sex addiction, mm-hmm. are there 12-step programs for that?
There certainly are. Sexual Addiction Anonymous, or Sexual Anonymous groups.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, there could even be one in Ames. A lot of support groups, it seems like, are moving towards the internet, where you have to pay a fee
uh-huh.
to be part of the group, which I think is just because we're moving to that internet age. But there certainly are groups that meet in person.
Mm-hmm.
Des Moines would likely be the closest right. place,
okay.
if I were to guess. I did not mm-hmm. look that up before I came. Whether it's in the DSM-5 or not, people certainly do struggle from this compulsive behavior. It is real. It does happen. There are signs to look for, and it is treatable.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM, Story County in Ames. I'm Jim Werbel. I'm one of your hosts for today. And we've just been listening to a recorded interview with Michelle De La Riva, a therapist with Community and Family Resources who's an expert on addictions. Michelle had a lot to say about the cause and treatment of addictions is borne out in our next interview. In this final interview, we'll be hearing from two long-term members of Alcoholics Anonymous, or AA, about their experiences of alcoholism and recovery. In accord with AA's policy of anonymity, we'll be using pseudonyms in this interview. Welcome to the show. I would personally like to thank both of you. We have Al and Frank here today to talk about something so personal as addiction. I understand that both of you attend AA meetings. When you say something at an AA meeting, you usually start by saying your name and that you're an alcoholic. What does it mean to be an alcoholic?
This is Frank. To me, it means not being able to resist the temptation to drink, even though it is hurting me physically and will eventually kill me.
That's a pretty stark statement, to kill you. What does that mean?
It means that the consequences of alcoholism, if the drinking proceeds, it gets worse and worse, the physical consequences will result in early death. Cirrhosis of the liver, all sorts of medical problems, organ failure, and then there's the potential for accidents and problems caused by driving drunk.
How about you, Al?
I think my definition has changed of what an alcoholic is as I've been through the program. I think when I started, it was just that I drank all the time. It got worse as the years went on. And I think now where I am more is that, and this is what the program teaches us, is that for many of us, we wanted life to be different than what it was. So we turn to something, and it can be anything. It can be drugs. It can be alcohol. It can be shopping. It doesn't matter what the addiction is. But when life wasn't the way we wanted it to be, then we turn to the substance to try and change whatever the circumstances were. And so alcohol allows you to blot out what's in your life or to somehow try to alter what reality is. And I think that's where programs like this really help, because it's not just about quitting drinking. It's about addressing those things in your life that are leading to the addiction instead.
What Al says here, that's really very good. I focused on the consequences of alcohol addiction. He focused on the causes.
Consequence neither of you have mentioned is disruption in your social life and your family life and so on. Did either of you experience that?
Yes, very definitely. When I was drinking, at the last time that I relapsed and was drinking, I was drinking before work, during work, And I was probably what's called a functional alcoholic, but I wasn't doing a very good job.
And I didn't admit to myself that I was an alcoholic for some period of time, even at meetings. I just thought I drank a lot. You know, so there were a lot of consequences.
You attended AA meetings for quite a while before you realized you were an alcoholic in your own head. Is that common?
I think so. It's hard to get those words out of your mouth the first time, but...
Well, I am an alcoholic.
Uh-huh.
Is it possible to go to meetings then without saying that? You can just sit and listen? Is that?
Oh, what? Absolutely.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And so you don't even necessarily have to have stopped, although we do recommend that you don't come to meetings drunk.
Was there a special event that made you decide to attend AA meetings? A catalytic event?
Yeah, I went to the hospital and dried out, and they suggested that I get that I go to AA meetings.
Now, what does that mean, going to the hospital and drying out?
To not drink for a period of days. Draw from alcohol. You can go into DTs or things like
right,
that.
Right.
And so you can have very severe physical consequences to withdraw from the addiction.
There are some similarities with my experience. I too, went to the hospital. I stayed there for about 3 weeks and dried out, as Al says. And when I was discharged from the hospital, in that process, I had received some counseling, and they suggested that I go to AA meetings as a continuing form of support. This is an interesting thing. I had been, for years, philosophically opposed to the 12-step concept, primarily because of its religious aspect. Focus on spiritual development and a higher power and so forth. When I got out of the hospital and went to a few of these meetings for the first time, I became aware that it wasn't really necessary to believe in a higher religious power to benefit from this program.
In other words, the higher power can be the power of the group and so on?
It definitely can be.
Mm-hmm.
It can be just about anything that is not you.
Right.
Or not mm-hmm. yourself.
Not you,
you know.
Alone, anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
That as an individual, I can't control it, but there's something out there, and that can be the group. It can be any concept that you have, or really no concept even, as long as you're not trying to run the show yourself.
What happens at an AA meeting that makes it easier for you to deal with your addictions?
What the whole program does is it really is an introspective program. When you go through, work your way through the 12 steps, you really learn about yourself and what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. You might call them character defects. An example might be that you always want to be in control of a situation or something like that. And then you start to realize how that affects your life when you are wrapped up in one of these character defects, and it helps you learn to basically live life in a very healthy and supported way. Sometimes I think a lot of alcoholics feel like everybody else got the rule book and they didn't. And a lot of what AA does is it just teaches you how to live a happy and productive life, and you don't need anything to change that.
Frankly, that made me feel stronger.
Uh-huh.
Knowing that people that I knew and respected were finding help with this program was a great motivator for
sure.
me. I think of it as these meetings as a pool of sanity that I can dip into and recharge myself.
Yeah, what are the 12 steps? And Frank's got a list here.
There are 12 items on the list. The first one is that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two is we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And third step is that we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him.
Or her.
or her.
I have to add that.
Yes.
It was all written in the 1930s.
Fourth step is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That's a very important one. Fifth step, admitted to God or to our higher power, to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Sixth step is that we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seventh, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The eighth step is that we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Ninth step is that we made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Tenth step, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11th, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him or her. 12th step is, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And that was written, as Al said, in the 1930s. And so there is language here that, for example, I don't really believe in. The references to God, I'm not a religious person.
But you could put it another way.
You can.
Yeah.
You could. And I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think in large part when you hear those, what it's really teaching you is how to lead a moral, ethical life,
self-examined
life,
yeah,
and be content. You find who you are, and you're content with that, and you don't need something outside of yourself to change what you are.
So let me summarize what AA seems to be doing. A lot of it focuses on self-examination, mm-hmm, and relying on others to help you improve the quality of your life, of which, in your case, is alcohol impedes.
I think that's very accurate. And when you get to that point, and it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, this can take a period of weeks, years, you know, to really get to that point where you're very content with yourself. But then you don't feel that need for that fulfillment from something else. And I really want to stress, it can be alcohol, it could be drugs, it could be sex, it could be shopping, it could be any number of different things that you use. A lot of people that come in say they felt like they had a hole and they were trying to fill that hole with something. But what the program does is to fill that hole, basically, and be content with the life that you are building.
And
with the limited nature of human life, and nothing's perfect in this life.
Very true. The aspect of power of the group, too, in these meetings is, for me, very important. The people in these meetings become friends, and
even more than friends.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a strong relationship,
close
relationship.
For me, one of the things that I get out of these meetings is a sense of belonging, a sense of gratitude for the support that I get. And I think one of the things that keeps me from relapsing is a strong desire not to disappoint these people that I've become close to.
Right.
That's one of the consequences of alcoholism is isolation, and I don't like that.
You know, along those lines, too, I'd like to point out that there are a lot of meetings around Central Iowa, and the first one I went to, I didn't care for. It was very strongly religious, and I'm not a very strongly religious person. And I had to go to a couple of meetings to find one that I felt comfortable with.
Different meetings, you mean?
To go to different meetings and different groups to find one. And there's small groups, there's large groups, there's all kinds of different groups.
How many different groups are there in the Story County area?
Maybe 30 meetings
something
a week,
like,
or something like that?
Yeah, as many as 7 to 10 different groups. And the number of meetings, as Al says, probably 30 to 35 a week. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are some groups that meet every day. Some groups meet at noon. Some groups meet in the evening.
Early birds in the morning, yeah. Weekends. There's all different times. And you can call AA or go to an AA website to get the meeting times.
I was reminded, listening to you mention the word gratitude, Frank. Anne Lamott uses three types of prayer. One is help, one is thanks or gratitude, and the other is wow. It sounds like AA kind of taps into that. There's a time when you do say help, mm-hmm. you do say thanks, and there's a time at the end, after you get things together, there's a wow.
I think for me, the gratitude is the huge part. Almost every day I do when I wake up, I do a little, I just call it a gratitude list. And, you know, it starts at the very top of the list of, gee, I'm glad we're not at war. I'm glad that I have a house. I'm glad that I had food today. And, you know, you start with those big things that my children are all healthy and happy and things like that. And pretty soon that little problem that you had is kind of put in perspective, it seems like. So mm-hmm. when you really live a life where there's a lot of gratitude, it just makes a huge difference.
Summarize. Could you sort of give an overview? What's the big difference that AA has made in your life? I mean, before and after.
I was angry all the time. I was angry at everything. I was angry at the driver ahead of me. I was angry at people at work. I was angry with my kids or my family, and not real overtly, but just this kind of inside discontent, anger. And that has completely disappeared. And now I live, I think, in a life where I'm just very grateful, as I said before, and calm and relaxed. And it's just a world of difference.
For me also, it has improved my relationships with other people to the point that I don't fear interacting with people. When I was drinking, before I did go into the AA program, I was a different person, and I didn't like myself very much. Today, that's changed. And I think it's because of the associations and the things that I have learned about myself through this program.
Many of us see other family members or friends with addiction issues. How does one steer a family member or friend towards an AA group other than going to the hospital?
People have to want to go to AA. Generally, we have what we call hitting bottom, that life gets so bad that you are willing to do anything to improve your life. And chances are good nobody else can do that for you. You have to want to do it for yourself. You can be court-ordered into it. You can be sent from the hospital. You can have family members pressure you. But until you're ready to go and do it, chances are it's not going to be terribly successful.
So, in other words, the person has to find AA by themselves?
There's another sister program that's called Al-Anon, and that's for family members of alcoholics or if they suspect someone has a problem with alcohol. I am not an Al-Anon member, but my understanding is that it helps you not support the alcoholic or enable the alcoholic so that eventually they do get to that point where life is so bad that they want to go on their own.
But with me, the road to recovery began with intervention from friends.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I was ready at that point to accept the fact that I had a problem.
Well, thank you both very much, Al and Frank. These are pseudonyms, of course, for coming to tell us about this.
And thank you for sharing very personal aspects of your life that may influence some people down the pike. We are grateful today to all of our guests who are willing to speak out on a topic that influences many people. There is help available through different websites as well as counseling resources that we highlighted earlier in the meeting.
That's it for Local Talk. We've been your hosts for today, Kay Patuck and Jim Werbel.
Today we spoke with three people on using pseudonyms, Jane Doe, Al, and Frank. We also spoke with Michelle De La Riva, a therapist and executive director of Community and Family Resources, a nonprofit organization helping people learn healthy behaviors to prevent and recover from addictions.
Local Talk was engineered today by Rebecca Brown. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron.
KHOI is now streaming live online at khoifm.org, where you can also find archives of KHOI previous shows. Please remember that you as a listener are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.